This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A leading voice in climate science calls us to fight off the powers of fossil fuels that profit from destruction of our climate and biosphere. Professor Michael Mann has just released his book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back the Planet. Thrust into the spotlight with the so-called hockey stick graph, showing global warming spiraling out of control, Michael Mann waged his own battle against climate deniers. But all the time he continued world-level scientific research and publishing. Dr. Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State and Director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. His most recent book is The Madhouse Effect with Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist Tom Tolles. From the great state of Pennsylvania, Michael Mann, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
What historic times. By the time of this broadcast, we trust a new president of the United States will no longer deny the reality of climate change. Michael, what does a Democratic sweep of Congress and the presidency mean for the reinstatement of American climate science as a public purpose?
Yeah, well, it means a lot. We have now gotten rid of a president who not only denied that climate change is real, but in fact did everything within his power to sabotage efforts to actually act on climate. And he was enabled by a Senate, a Republican Senate, that furthered his agenda and blocked any effort for, say, a congressional climate bill to be passed. So now we've got a president who campaigned on this issue and has a mandate to use broad executive powers to ensure that we do everything we can from the executive branch side of things, institute policies, diplomacy, re-enter the Paris Agreement, and use the various agencies to advance climate policy when it comes to funding for renewable energy, when it comes to carbon-friendly agricultural policies, when it comes to the Treasury and requiring companies to disclose climate risk. So there are a whole bunch of things that the executive, the chief executive, you know, Joe Biden can do. But now he's going to have a Senate, which is narrowly in Democratic hands. It looks like it will be a 50-50 split, with the Democrat Chuck Schumer now becoming the majority leader of the Senate. That means a climate bill can actually make it to the Senate floor. Mitch McConnell prevented any sort of climate legislation from even getting a vote in the Senate. It was dead on arrival. Now we have, you know, Senate that's in Democratic hands. We will get a vote on a climate bill or set of bills. There will be obviously support from Democrats. I think there will be a handful of moderate Republicans who will join with Democrats to actually pass meaningful climate legislation in this next term. So, you know, there are reasons to be cautiously optimistic that we're turning the corner, but not a moment too late. We're already seeing, of course, the devastating impacts that climate inaction has wrought thus far.
Well, yes, we talk about America's military allies, but we also had climate allies, and it's going to be a huge relief for the people in Europe and really the people around the world to think that America could again enter a leadership role in the international arena.
Yeah, no question. I think that's probably the most important development, that the United States will once again engage with the world community, will lead on this issue, which we did back in the days of Barack Obama. He faced a, you know, an intransigent Republican Congress, but he used his executive authority to act on climate domestically. That allowed him to come to the table with other world leaders in good faith and say, look, we're doing what we can. We want to help lead in, you know, international efforts to rein in carbon emissions. The Paris, the bilateral agreement with China and the U.S. that laid sort of the groundwork for the Paris Agreement. And so that's critical. We have a president who will lead on this issue. He's appointed John Kerry, who has a tremendous legacy when it comes to, you know, his role in the Senate as a senator and co-sponsoring climate legislation, which ultimately failed because there wasn't Republican support for it. But he spearheaded climate legislation. He led the diplomatic efforts to establish both that bilateral agreement between China and the U.S. under the Obama administration, and he played a major role in negotiating the Paris Agreement. And so he has impressive diplomatic bona fides. He's respected by the world community, and he will be leading the international effort for the Biden administration as their new envoy, their special envoy on climate. And moreover, he will sit on the National Security Council, which is an important development as well, that reflects a recognition that climate now has to constitute a major consideration as we consider issues of conflict and security.
Well, yes, pretty shortly we're going to be talking about your new book, The New Climate War. But first I wanted to mention that in September I interviewed Dr. Kevin Trenberth, and he left a key position at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research because the funding was slashed under Trump. Last week we spoke with Dr. Ben Santer, who wrote an op-ed in Scientific American. He's one of the most cited climate scientists, but he was defunded at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. I can only guess at the number of good scientists who have left or been discouraged. Can America rebuild its leadership role in climate science?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. Both of those folks are good friends of mine and deeply respected climate scientists. And I think Kevin was sort of ready to transition. He was at that point in his career, and he went back to New Zealand where he's from. He's still doing well. In fact, we're collaborating on an article right now. And Ben Santer remains a leading figure in climate science. And, you know, he will find a good position, and he will still remain sort of one of the leading scientists in the field. But there was quite a bit of damage done, as you know. A war of attrition, the efforts by the Trump administration to basically, in essence, deny financial funding to various scientific institutions, government institutions that do climate research, or to reassign his henchmen sort of in the various agencies, reassign scientists who had been working on climate issues to other areas. We couldn't have withstood another 4 years of Trump, and I was very clear about that before this last election when it comes, for example, to our scientific contributions, the scientific contributions of the American climate science community to this critical issue. We couldn't have afforded another 4 years of Trump, but I think we did survive this assault in large part because fairly early on, the administration recognized that picking a fight with the scientific community wasn't a smart path forward for them. And so they didn't do as much damage as they might have done. They could have done a lot more damage. Instead, they sort of, as I alluded to, were engaged more in a war of attrition, sort of just denying resources to scientists, reassigning scientists. But those scientists are still working. And now under the Biden administration, as we restore rightful funding to the various science agencies in the country that work on issues related to climate, I think we will regain that sort of lost foothold when it comes to our furthering of science, climate science here in the United States, but moreover, when it comes to dealing with the climate crisis itself.
Michael Mann, what fired you up to write your new book, and why did you frame the climate crisis as a war?
Well, the title of my previous book was The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, and it's about, you know, a war not of our choosing. The, you know, scientific community, climate scientists have found themselves under attack for decades now by fossil fuel companies, the various front groups and attack dogs that they have funded in their effort to discredit the science of climate change, to confuse the public and policymakers about the reality and threat of climate change. And so we have been in this war with powerful vested interests looking to discredit the science, to intimidate scientists, to block any effort to solve this problem, to get off the burning of fossil fuels. Now, the new climate war refers to the fact that what we're seeing now, as it simply becomes impossible for talking heads to deny that climate change is real, because we're all seeing the impacts of it play out in real time with our own two eyes, on our television screens and our newspaper headlines. It's no longer credible to deny that climate change is happening. And so what the forces of inaction, and I call them the inactivists, in this book, and that is to say fossil fuel interests and those promoting those interests. What they've done instead is turned to a whole new array of tactics that are still intended to prevent us from weaning ourselves off fossil fuels, from transitioning away from fossil fuels. Every year we remain addicted to fossil fuels is another year where the fossil fuel industry makes billions and billions of dollars of profits. And so what they're doing now is engaging in other tactics intended to at least delay this transition by dividing the climate advocate community, getting scientists fighting with each other over tactics. It's a divide and conquer approach. Deflecting attention from the need for systemic solutions, for policy solutions, to individual behavior, as if it's just about each of us behaving better, changing our diets, not traveling as much or flying, deflecting attention away from the needed systemic solutions. And that plays in fact, to division. If you can get people arguing with each other over their lifestyle choices, that's a great way to divide the community. And that's something that they're doing. Another front in the new climate war is the sort of promotion of doomism, despair. And ironically, many, you know, environmental progressives fall victim to this feeling that it's too late to do anything, that we've already locked in civilization ending climate change and there's nothing we can do about it. And to the extent that these bad actors can sort of foment this feeling of doom and gloom, that it potentially leads, you know, climate advocates down that same path of inaction as outright denial of the problem. And so we have to be aware that these tactics are being waged right now. They're very effective. In many ways, they're more insidious because they're intended to sort of weaponize, to some extent, people of goodwill and good intentions, to weaponize them into fighting with each other, falling into despair, not demanding action on the part of our policymakers. And so I felt, you know, in writing this book that I wanted to make people understand that, look, this war that we wish we didn't have to fight, but, you know, it's not our choice. There is a war being waged by the fossil fuel industry and their advocates. That war isn't over. It's just that the tactics are changing. We need to recognize that because we are so close to the tipping point, not the bad tipping points that we worry about, climate tipping points, and there are some out there, and we do have to worry about that. That's part of why this is so urgent. But there are the good tipping points, the tipping point in public consciousness when it comes to addressing this crisis, and I think we're very close to that.
It could come in a wave. We hope that that wave will come. But meanwhile, as you say, there has been almost an arms race of pessimism, even within the climate movement. A few people sold their possessions and said tearful goodbyes to one another. They were talking about extinction. And yet, here we are. So what are some of the climate fears we can do without, at least for now?
Well, you know, runaway warming. The science just doesn't support that. It's this idea that's been out there, and it's not grounded in good science. There are a few articles that are out there that promote this, but it isn't at all the mainstream scientific understanding. The idea that, you know, the Arctic will release massive amounts of methane that have been trapped in the permafrost, and that will lead to runaway warming. There's just no evidence for that. There is evidence for these so-called carbon cycle feedbacks, which is to say we warm up the planet, we do release some of that frozen methane, and it amplifies the effect. It's what we call positive feedback. It's a bad thing. It might sound good, but it's bad. It amplifies the warming, and that's real. But the dominant cause of the warming is going to be the continued burning of fossil fuels if we continue down the road that we're on. And so we have to recognize that the only, in a sense, the greatest thing, to quote FDR, the greatest thing to fear is fear itself. The doomism could easily lead us down a path of despair and inaction that prevents us from confronting the problem at its source, which is the burning of fossil fuels. And there's a little bit of scientific good news here over the last decade or so. As the experiments that we run have become more realistic, one thing that's emerged is that if you stop burning carbon, if you stop emitting carbon into the atmosphere, then the oceans in particular naturally start to draw down that carbon. The Earth pulls some of that carbon out of the atmosphere, and those carbon dioxide levels actually start to drop a bit. Now, that sort of counterbalances what we call the delayed warming, which is that once you put those greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and you start to warm the planet, there's just a certain amount of thermal inertia, as we call it. The oceans are sluggish. They continue to warm for decades in response to the CO2 we've already put out there. So that would tend to cause additional warming in the future, but the drawdown would actually counteract that. And the two nearly balance out, and the almost magical result is that when we stop burning carbon, global surface temperatures stabilize very quickly within a matter of a few years. And that means that our actions now have a direct and immediate impact on this problem, and that's very enabling.
That is something surprising. We've just learned really this year. I have an interview coming up with Andrew McDougall in Nova Scotia, the lead author of a paper published in June 2020 about that finding, that actually it could cool down a bit if we could just stop. And we learned in the pandemic we can slow down infection by staying home for a while. Many of us had to cut our consumption, our shopping, our travel. If we really have a climate emergency, what can we learn from the pandemic responses, Michael Mann?
Yeah, thanks. It's a great question. It's one of the questions I focus on in the last chapter of the new climate war. You know, what lessons can we take away from the pandemic? There's so many of them. We could spend an hour, my friend, just talking about what those lessons are. There are all sorts of lessons about fragility and sustainability writ large, and, you know, how fragile our existence on this planet really is. Society can be turned upside down. Civilization can be turned upside down by a microscopic organism. And so I think there's some larger questions that it raises about, you know, how we can live sustainably on a planet, you know, with finite resources, food and water and space, how to live more sustainably on this planet. That's an important conversation that I hope will be ongoing for a number of years. But there are some more immediate lessons, as you allude to, about sort of how we tackle the climate crisis. The good news is, as you say, look, you know, if we act, in this case, the lockdown and the social distancing weren't really voluntary actions. We were forced to do that by the pandemic, and we saw that that did have an immediate impact. Carbon emissions are going to be down about 7% this year. That's the good news, right? We're actually sort of coming down the ramp now, as we need to do. The bad news is we've got to do that, you know, 7% roughly every year, 7% upon 7%, and then 7% more, and 7% more the year after that for 10 years if we're going to bring carbon emissions down fast enough to avert catastrophic warming of the planet, more than 1.5 degrees Celsius or roughly 3 degrees Fahrenheit warming. To do that, behavioral change alone simply isn't going to be enough. We are going to need to decarbonize civilization. We're going to need to decarbonize all the sectors of the modern economy. And that requires serious systemic change, not just behavioral change. But we can do it. And, you know, a number of things have come together. And one of them, really just today, as we speak, it's becoming clear that Democrats will likely control the U.S. Senate, which means we'll see a climate bill or set of bills on the Senate floor now. And we might actually see them pass Congress and get signed by a President Biden. So we're in a position to act. The political winds have sort of aligned in a favorable way. And we've learned some important lessons as well. And then finally, and I would be remiss in not mentioning the youth climate movement, Greta Thunberg and the other youth climate activists around the world who have raised sort of global attention on this issue and have recentered this issue where it belongs. This isn't just about science and policy and politics. It's about ethics, intergenerational ethics, our obligation not to degrade this planet for future generations. So I think all of these strands have come together now in a favorable way. They've aligned in a way that really places us at the precipice now of really acting meaningfully on this crisis before it's too late. And so I'm cautiously optimistic as we go into 2021 that we'll look back at 2020, as awful as it was, as sort of the turning point when it came to climate action.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is famous American climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann. We're talking about his new book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back the Planet. Now, Michael, the governments of the world, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and plenty of climate models assume large amounts of carbon will be recaptured from the atmosphere and stored underground out of the loop. Is that happening, and can it happen fast enough to really avoid the climate tragedy?
It's sort of a muddled conversation. I think the truth is somewhere in between. You know, I think that some of the scenarios that have been put forward, for example, in the IPCC assessments, are really, you know, place too much emphasis on as yet non-existent technology, technology that in principle could be used, but there's no evidence yet that can be scaled up quickly enough to make a meaningful dent in our carbon emissions. At the edges, it could make a real difference. And so, you know, there may be some role for artificial carbon uptake. You know, we said the oceans are going to be continue to take some of the carbon out of the atmosphere. They're working on our behalf. Forests do that. The biosphere does that. Reforestation and afforestation can and stopping deforestation certainly can help do that, can help the Earth better sort of naturally sequester carbon. But that mostly acts at the margins. Unless we tackle this problem at its source, which is the ongoing spigot of carbon dioxide coming out of our burning of fossil fuels for energy and transportation and industry and everything else, unless we tackle this problem at its source, artificial and natural carbon uptake efforts are almost like deck chairs on the Titanic, the metaphorical deck chairs on the Titanic. So we shouldn't allow them to serve as a distraction for the true task at hand, which is stopping the burning of fossil fuels. But some of these technologies may help at the margins, may help us, you know, keep CO2 levels below catastrophic levels. What we can't allow them to be is a crutch for not taking the more essential action of stopping the burning of fossil fuels.
Reading your book, I came to wonder, what is the sunrise movement, and is it helping or hurting the cause of climate action?
Well, like any movement, you know, I think the sunrise movement, I see it as sort of part of this larger movement, the youth climate movement, to raise awareness about the climate crisis, and they've done a real service. And so the movement sort of reflects a younger demographic, a sort of a youthful sector of our population, just like the youth climate movement writ large. And I think it's been really important in sort of shifting the whole conversation. That having been said, like any organization, at times, you know, they've taken positions that I'm not in full agreement with. And I talk about this in the book at some length. For example, the importance of using market mechanisms as one of the lever arms in tackling the climate crisis. Putting a price on carbon, subsidies for renewable energy. Market mechanisms are one of the tools in the toolbox, and we need to use every tool that's available to us to tackle this crisis. So I think simply taking some of those tools off the table, as the Sunrise Movement is sort of alluded to at times, I don't agree with that particular position. But look, you know, there's room for a healthy sort of debate about the specifics, the policy specifics, when it comes to tackling this problem. On the larger matter that's relevant here, the need to act immediately and to recognize that we do have a crisis. You know, we're all, you know, the Sunrise Movement and I and all of my other colleagues who've been advocating for climate action, we're on the same basic page. And so this is really a debate about some of the specifics of climate policy. And, you know, there's room for that debate. That's the debate we should be having.
Now, I think the public is going to take years to get out of the shell shock from this onslaught of the coronavirus pandemic. Economies are battered. Countless families are grieving. How can we, at the same time, demand wrenching changes when people just want to get back to good old normal?
Yeah, it's great. Well, that's why, you know, I always call it the great, there's a term that people are using, the great realignment or something. Let's do both at the same time, right? Let's rebuild our infrastructure and our economy in a clean, sensible way, in a way that embraces clean energy, renewable energy. We can do both. You know, it's a false choice that is sometimes set up by the inactivists, the forces of inaction, who would like you to think that we have to make a choice between sort of saving our environment and growing our economy. We can do both at the same time. And, you know, clean energy, the clean energy transition, the sorts of policies that Biden and the Democrats are talking about now. We'll do both of those things. It'll get us going again, and it'll rebuild our infrastructure in a much better way, in a clean, green, and sort of in a way that just feels right. Look, the age of fossil fuels has come to an end. It's time to move on. And this is really an opportunity to accelerate that transition.
The coming years are going to be kind of hard for growing food. We're going to have big storms and fires, unstable weather, more record heat waves. But I'm wondering, you've used the analogy of a war. When America has been attacked, or when any country's been attacked, the people tend to work together in a common cause, and perhaps these extreme events will galvanize us to work fast enough to do more.
I think that's exactly right. One of my sci-fi author heroes, Kim Stanley Robinson, has written a wonderful book that people should check out, Ministry for the Future. And what I like so much about it, it doesn't sugarcoat it. It recognizes what you just said. We're going to have some tough times ahead. Dangerous climate change has already arrived. Dangerous impacts have already arrived. There's no way to avoid them. But there is still time to make the changes that ensure that we do see a much brighter future. And he sort of, there are too many dystopian sort of narratives that we see in sci-fi and cli-fi, as it's called, of a world, a degraded world resulting from climate inaction. But there are also the possibilities of utopias. We've sort of alluded to that, building back clean and green, and rethinking some basic questions about what sort of world we want to have, basic questions about sustainability. And Kim Stanley Robinson sort of paints a credible future path where we do go through some upheaval. We have to deal with some of the devastating impacts of climate change, but we do come out on the other side in a pretty good-looking place. And so I think that future is possible, but it demands immediate action, and I think we're going to see that action.
All right, so I'm picturing people getting your new book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back the Planet, and they tuck it under their arms, and they go out and they do something with it. And how can people use your new book?
Well, you know, they could use it as biofuel. No, just kidding. Joke. You know, I'm hoping that the book, you know, engages people. It awakens there are so many good folks who are on the right side of this issue, who want to do the right thing, who have been led astray by the inactivists, by the forces of inaction. And I want them to recognize some of the tactics that are being used, in particular the sort of purveying of doom and gloom that is intended to dispirit them and inactivate them. So I want them to be engaged. I want them to recognize that they're being played by some of the bad actors right now, in a way that's a bit more subtle. And it's important to recognize and combat those tactics that are being used today in the new climate war. But let's not be too distracted. We have to combat those tactics, but we have to stay focused on the prize, which is moving forward and acting, doing everything we can from an individual standpoint, but from a collective standpoint as well. And so I hope that people read this book and come away empowered to act when it comes to the greatest challenge we face as a civilization, the climate crisis.
You have been listening to the Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State, Dr. Michael Mann. And you can find out more about his new book and his latest work at michaelmann.net. I will also put links for you to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Michael Mann, I thank you so much for your tireless battle to help the public understand.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I appreciate your efforts to get the word out there.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. On a personal note, while I admire 98% of Michael's work, I do not agree we can continue to grow the economy and save the climate. In our current time and the foreseeable decade, any growth of national or gross domestic product will create more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That's just the way it works. I think we have to shrink the consumer economy even further than during the pandemic, simplify life, and reorder social rewards towards those who create social welfare for all.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.